Okay, I think everybody's here and we should be good to go.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Ead, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, April 3rd, 2024, and we have five cases on our calendar today. Three of which are going to be scheduled or are scheduled for oral argument, and two are non-oral. I'm Judge Sarah Wheelock, and I'm sitting on a panel today with Judges Jessen and Ead, and we're holding our hearings via Zoom.gov. So allow me to address a few items preliminarily. Oral arguments are recorded by the court, and the audio of the recordings is generally available on the court's website within about 24 hours. I just also want to note that the appellate rules prohibit anyone from making an audio or video recording of oral argument unless you have obtained the court's permission 24 hours in advance and agreed to comply with certain rules. And with that, Marshall, please call the first case this morning.
First case this morning is A24-0095 in the matter of the civil commitment of Terry Lee Bryant.
Counsel, you probably both know that you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you could both indicate whether you see a clock in the upper left-hand corner of your screens, that is how we are keeping time on the Zoom platform. And so, yeah, make sure you can see that so you are aware of your timing. And counsel, please introduce yourselves at the beginning of your argument so we have a clear pronunciation of your name and your client's name, and let us know if there's a particular way you want us to refer to you during argument this morning. You can change your name that appears in the corner of the box that you're showing up in for Zoom.gov if you need to. And please mute yourself, but leave your video on when you are not arguing. Finally, and very importantly, if either of you has any problems with the technology at any point, just let me know and we'll stop. We'll take a break. We'll figure it out and try and resolve whatever the issue is because we want to ensure that we hear from each of you. With that, there should be 15 minutes on the clock. And counsel for appellant, you can begin when you are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Tone, and I am the attorney for Terry Bryant, who is the appellant in this case. A petition was filed seeking to commit Mr. Bryant as a sexually dangerous person and sexual psychopathic personality, SDP and SPP. After a contested hearing, the court granted the petition, and this appeal follows. There are two issues that I wanted to touch on this morning. The first is the trial court's adoption of the county's proposed order, essentially verbatim. And the second is the highly likely dangerous to others criteria for commitment. Turning to that first point, we know from the Minnesota Supreme Court that they strongly disfavor trial courts adopting proposed orders from the parties, especially verbatim, and prefer that trial courts independently author their findings. It is not reversible error per se to adopt a proposed order, but it is highly discouraged. And the reason for that is because it raises serious questions about whether the trial court independently evaluated the evidence, which is the critical issue in this case. We had a 3-day contested hearing. The trial court heard from 8 witnesses and received approximately 3,700 pages worth of exhibits into the record. After trial, the parties submitted final arguments and proposed orders. 16 days after the case was taken under advisement, the trial court issued the order committing Mr. Bryant. The county's proposed order in this case included 624 findings of fact. The trial court's order had 623 findings of fact. It combined two of the county's proposed findings into one. Of those 623 findings, 10 varied slightly from the county's proposed order. The trial court had 100. Sorry, go ahead.
If I may, because given the gravity of the decision for your client in this case, I went back and compared, especially like what the county's proposals were versus what the trial court's decisions were when it came to that. What I see is, and I think you agree, is the critical issue in this case was there sufficient evidence on the highly likely and dangerous to others factor. And while if you just look at the numbers, I understand what you're saying, kind of the number of findings, but it does seem to me that a lot of that comes down to the expert's credibility. And the trial court did add additional language dealing with addressing the credibility of both of the court-appointed examiners in language in, I think it's 530 and finding 533, plus a couple of other things. But especially since that's at the crux of this, it made me think, well, shouldn't that be enough?
And I guess, yes, I mean, that's 100% my argument. And that's absolutely my concern, especially when we're dealing with the constitutional liberty interest at stake. And I think, I guess, when I was analyzing and comparing the orders, what struck me was that, you know, by my math, I think the court added 20 sentences of independent drafting. And the additions that they made were not on the issues that were really that contested. It was issues really not contested by Mr. Bryant at trial.
And I guess my question was, Ms. Thome, but that two of those additions dealing with the credibility of the examiners, I think, don't those go to the heart of the issue enough? And I'm asking because I do understand your overall point.
Certainly. And I guess here's my answer to that question. I don't think when I read the order, I don't believe that the trial court reconciled the varied and inconsistent opinions between the examiners. And so certainly I understand, I recognize that this court's role is not to reweigh the evidence. And I certainly agree and understand that the trial court has the discretion to determine what experts it feels are most credible and persuasive. However, that discretion is not unfettered. And this court does have an obligation to step in and review some of those determinations. And it reminds me of another commitment case, In re Edwards. That's a Court of Appeals case from 2019, 933 Northwest 2nd, 796. In that particular case, the commitment appeal panel granted the client a transfer based on the supporting opinion of one of the experts at trial. The Court of Appeals reversed that decision, finding that the evidence as a whole did not support the examiner's position. Therefore, the commitment appeal panel's decision. And I think that's the case here. And I tried to give various examples within my appellate brief of how I think both the experts were varied and inconsistent between themselves and how the trial court kind of credited both of them, even when they disagreed, and made findings that said Dr. One was credible, but then the findings and the evidence in the record shows that that was either not supported or disagreed with what the court ultimately found. So hopefully that kind of answers your question.
Counsel, wouldn't you agree, though, that the differences between their opinions aren't such that the court needed to make a distinction between I agree with expert A versus expert B? I mean, we're talking about diagnoses of the health, mental health disorders that were either specified or unspecified, but they seemed to me to be primarily similar in regard to what they were assessing, and that the differences between the two experts' opinions were really very minimal and didn't really go to the fact that I think you want us to get to, which is that somehow they did not demonstrate that Mr. Bryant met the criteria for either SPP or SDP.
I guess overall, I would not agree with that. I think when you look at kind of the issue of the diagnoses, that one's a little bit different. You know, those are really pretty subjective. And whether you kind of meet antisocial personality disorder or other specified personality disorder with antisocial traits, I agree with your point. They're very similar. So I don't think you necessarily have to say, you know, I accept this diagnosis and reject that one. But I think when you look at those opinions, and especially when you look at like the diagnoses piece of it, you know, you've got one doctor opining that she's following the DSM-5 to use her diagnoses, right? And then when walking through the criteria for the particular diagnoses that she provided, you know, she's acknowledging in her testimony that she didn't follow that book or that manual, you know, and so I think there's those kinds of fundamental issues in her process and her overall opinion that ought to be and need to be considered when you're making those credibility determinations as a district court. You know, and I think when you're looking at the varied and inconsistent opinions of examiners, it goes to all of the other issues too. You know, part of the Linehan factors and the risk assessment on that highly likely piece, and also, you know, who is or isn't a victim on the course of conduct piece of that as well.
Isn't part of the reason that the Supreme Court's rule on adoption of findings of fact that are proposed by a party wholesale a rule of disfavor rather than necessarily being reversible or error? Isn't that because there's an acknowledgement that there's going to be times where a district court agrees with the findings of fact and it may be appropriate for them to adopt them. And we don't even have a situation in this case where the district court did no editing and no changing. We have circumstances, I mean, specific paragraphs that you've identified where the district court actually made changes. So what is your response to that? Why shouldn't we consider this really within the district court's discretion to adopt those proposed findings as it did?
Again, I think you kind of have to look at the totality of it. The changes are so very minimal and are focused on the issues that really were not contested or very minimally contested. I certainly understand why district courts would and should be able to kind of adopt parties' findings of fact, as it relates to various issues and things like that. So certainly I don't think that's an issue. But I think you can't just kind of do this wholesale adoption. That's where you get into that disfavor. And to me, there just isn't a sufficient evidence here, especially given how quickly this order came out, that the trial court spent the time to independently evaluate anything. This was a gigantic record, with 3 days of very contested and confusing expert testimony, along with so much voluminous, evidence in the record and the paper. And so, to answer your question, I think certainly it is disfavored. It's not per se reversible. But you have to do more than just kind of add one sentence here or there. I didn't do the math, but 20 sentences out of 108 pages, that can't be a very high percentage of modification. The other point that I want to touch on, as I'm running out of time here, getting to the highly likely piece. One of my other really significant concerns was the trial court, when it's making the determination about the highly likely dangerous to others, is to consider the Linehan factors and the risk assessment tools. And the trial court has the authority to determine what evidence is most relevant. And it is supposed to explain what was most and least persuasive and important, and which Linehan factors were ultimately significant in that decision. And in this case, we have the trial court reviewing the Linehan factors. And as part of that review, it did discuss the various risk assessment tools. But there's no explanation as to what weight the court gave the Linehan factors as compared to the risk assessment tools. And I think an easy example can be found in that first Linehan factor, the demographic characteristics. I believe the order says that age is accounted for within the static 99R. However, there's no explanation that says the trial court then is giving weight to the static 99R, is giving weight to that Linehan factor, or both, which I think results in double counting. And, both in my argument to the trial court and within the brief, I tried to demonstrate and illustrate the overlap between Linehan and the risk assessment tools to show how that double counting can occur. And in this case, I thought it was particularly concerning that neither examiner had any idea about the potential for double counting, what that was, how to avoid it, and yet the district court still found them to both to be credible in that respect.
Ms. Stone, as far as your argument about the district court didn't explain enough how it was weighing these factors, well, and really going to the what, from your perspective, I understand is a wholesale adoption of the county's position. I mean, isn't the remedy there not to, as you suggest in your brief, to vacate the commitment, but just, remand this to the district court for additional findings so that we can, have appropriate appellate review?
Certainly, I obviously the court has the ability and the authority to do that. I would argue that it's not appropriate in this case. The court already had the opportunity to do what it was supposed to do, and I believe that didn't happen. And I think when you look at the totality of the evidence and the other arguments that we've made in this appeal, I don't believe that the record reasonably supports that Mr. Bryant meets the criteria for commitment. When you look at the record as a whole in this case. I did want to touch on just a couple points in the county's brief. The court made a finding that the actuarial tools underestimate recidivism for a variety of reasons. And when I reviewed the evidence and the record in this case, there's absolutely nothing in the trial transcripts or any exhibit that supports that position. In the brief, the county cited to various studies detailing that position, all of that was outside of the record. There's nothing to suggest that the trial court had any of that information available to it. So I do think that that finding is wholly unsupported and clearly erroneous. The other point that I wanted to kind of quick touch on here before I run out of time is the notion, kind of going back to the verbatim or near verbatim adoption of the order. Now, the county also suggests that perhaps the trial court was working on the decision prior to taking it under advisement. And I simply think that doesn't make any sense. You know, when you look at the comparisons between the proposed order and the county's order, the trial court didn't author any independent paragraphs or findings of fact. They just added sentences on to the county's brief. And so you can't, you know, add on to something that you don't yet have. And again, I think that time, you know, that short turnaround of time is really telling in terms of the independent evaluation. You know, I think we kind of, through your questions, you obviously understand the argument that I'm making, and I certainly don't need to just repeat what I've already articulated in my brief. So I'm happy to answer any kind of final questions if you have them. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. Next, we will turn to counsel for the respondent. And the clock has been reset. Counsel, please recall that I'd like you to introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument, and you can begin when you are ready.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Assistant Attorney General Angela Kiza, appearing on behalf of Morrison County in this case. And I'm put in sort of an unusual position because I'm kind of defending my proposed findings to the court and the court's adoption of most of them. What I would note about the issue with the adoption of the proposed findings is, as Ms. Stone indicated in her brief and somewhat in her argument, there were several changes. I think she kept better track than I did as far as what, you know, how many there were. But I think there were like 20 additions, 10 other changes. So there were several. It was obvious the court had gone through the proposed findings. When you're making so much of the proposed findings, at least before you get to the expert opinions, are just about the record and his criminal history and his personal history and things like that. So there's not a lot to debate about that. And there's, yes, the court could go through and change words here and there, but there's really not a lot of debate about the record supporting those findings. And from what my reading, I went over them again last night, and it seems like most of the changes were to the, I guess what you'd consider the important evidence in the case. The changes did go to her assessment on the credibility of the expert witnesses. Some of her comments or some of the additions went to the testimony of other witnesses who testified at trial. So I think that was, I mean, those were the important things to know, you know, what the court thought about different things, whether it was things that Mr. Bryan testified to or that victims or other lay witnesses testified to, or particularly these two experts. She specifically commented on some of the issues that appellant raised as far as Dr. Keller's lack of experience and some of the nomenclature that she used in her report that wasn't completely consistent with the words used in the records of the documents. Go ahead.
I understand what you're saying, counsel. You know, and you certainly in your brief cite a lot of cases where even if the practice is disfavored, this court and the Supreme Court, and maybe the Supreme Court cases too, has affirmed, right, the district court's order that adopts a party's order. But were any of the, I don't think any of those cases, and correct me if I'm wrong, were in civil commitment of sex offender cases. And
They actually were, but go ahead.
No, I mean, at least it is more concerning to me here where we're talking about civil commitment and indefinite commitment, not for something someone has specifically done as punishment, but a commitment for treatment, which will be, if history tells us anything, for a longer period of time. And where that's what's at stake, don't we have to ensure appropriate appellate review that's meaningful? Don't we need a district court order that's not largely following the county's proposal?
Well, no, not if the district court agrees with the findings that are proposed And I
But
wouldn't
how do
have.
we know? But how do we know that? Do we have enough differences to know that there wasn't that this independent analysis took place to
Well,
where
I
we
think.
don't have to send it back? That's my question.
Yes, I mean, I think we do. I think this is much different than the case with there wasn't any in toto adoption of examiner opinions. The court found credibility or made credibility determinations on each issue. And like I said, the changes that the court made and the additions that the court made had to do with the credibility of the experts, which is one of the main issues in this case, and with respect to their diagnoses, their the tests that they used, that their diagnoses were credible, that their diagnoses caused him to lack adequate control over his sexual impulses, that he had that course. So there were credibility determinations made throughout, and then also with respect to the other witnesses in the case. So I think that shows that the court did go through that process. And to Ms. Tone's point about 2 weeks versus 2 months, I am not a judge, but if I had 3,000 pages of documents and I'm waiting for findings, I'm sure going to start going through those documents while I wait for proposed findings. We obviously don't know exactly what the court did, but whether it was 2 months or 2 weeks, the court had time to go through the evidence in this case. That the pertinent parts of the evidence in the case were set forth in the proposed findings. The court did have all of that in, and it had it since, most of the background information anyway, since the petition was filed, 6 months ago or whenever the petition was filed. So.
But isn't the point that there were so few changes to the proposed findings that the idea, as I understood Ms. Tan's argument, that the district court meaningfully had started drafting anything that became the final order, seems very unlikely since the district court didn't really make that many changes. So that's why the 2 week time frame is significant.
Well, I'm saying you can't assume she didn't, the judge didn't start working on the case as far as reviewing the case and looking at the evidence. I mean, Ms. Tone's point is, or one of the things she says is, oh, there were 3,000 exhibits or whatever, or pages of documents. Well, that's something that can be looked at before you're actually drafting the findings or reviewing the proposed findings and adding to those, making those changes. And to one of the things that Judge Justin asked about, and I did find this in my brief, this has happened several times in commitment cases that I cite on page 19 of my brief. In Ray Fernandez, there was no error where findings were largely adopted from the county attorney's proposed findings. In Ray Foley, there was no error where the trial court made significant changes, deletions, and additions to the proposed findings. In Ray Ivey, there was no error where the district court adopted the state's proposed findings of fact in their entirety. And Ivey challenged the court's ability to take the necessary time to carefully review all the testimony and exhibits. In Ray Jones, there was no error where the court adopted the petitioner's proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law in their entirety after it carefully reviewed them and found them properly describe the evidence at trial. In Ray Swan. So I mean there are several sites and several situations where the court did less than the court did here. And as I said, if you read through the substance of what the court added, it shows that the court was paying attention to what mattered from a credibility standpoint, from an evidentiary standpoint, on the important issues that are set forth, particularly in the section with respect to the elements for commitment and the expert testimony and evidence on those elements.
In this case, if I can. So kind of shifting a little bit given the time here. So if the panel agrees with you that there is enough here to on the factual findings of the court, then we go to right to our job. Is there, does the evidence meet the statutory requirements for commitment? So, and that's one where when I look at this case, where we have the district court found, I think based on Dr. Doherty's testimony, that Mr. Bryant does not have a significant history of overtly violent behavior. He has a moderate level of psychopathy. And he says that if he's not committed, sorry, he would go back to CORE where he at least had some marginal progress. I mean, I understand marginal. In the past, I mean, that seems to really call into question whether that meets, for an example, kind of that history of violent behavior, fact, is it a factor or thing, a matter we're supposed to look at under Linehan? I mean, those. So I have some questions just about that as well, if you could address them.
Well, so history of violent behavior is one of the factors that that Linehan addresses if evidence is presented, it's something the court's supposed to consider. So the Linehan factors are if there's evidence of these things, the court should consider that in addition to all the other evidence. And if you look at the Ince case, I mean, the court is the one to determine the weight and the importance of the various factors. So while the court notes, I mean, it shows the court considered that. But despite the fact that he doesn't have a significant history of violence, he does have a history of some violence. The court found, based on all the other information, the other Linehan factors, and all of the tools that the court used, that he's highly likely to reoffend sexually. And you'll note the theme kind of throughout the proposed findings. And this is and these are things that, to my recollection, these are things that the were in the things that the court changed as far as proposed findings go. There's this consistent theme with Mr. Bryant where he, despite any treatment efforts that he's made, despite the treatment in the community, he has consistently disregarded treatment principles, put himself in high-risk situations, put himself in the very situations repeatedly during treatment, in sex offender treatment, in prison, putting himself in the very situations where he acquired his last victim. To the point, and his disregard of any rules or any danger or any risk that he has, to the point that he exposed himself while he was in jail on the civil commitment hold in this case. This is not a guy who appreciates his risk. And that was a big concern for the court. And she consistently indicated that in her findings with respect to his high risk and with respect to in the SPP findings. With respect to the utter lack of ability to control his sexual impulses, with respect to the diagnostic factors there that you look at, the failure to appreciate consequences of personal acts, his impulsivity, those things, it's a big concern. It was a big concern to his agents. And despite the fact that one HRU officer thought there were still options in the community, which I don't even know if you look at the record if that's true, because if that's depending on how you interpreted court's last termination letter, which said he's not amenable to outpatient treatment. But after that HRU, that last HRU finding or whatever, now we have several experts who have looked at this individual and who have said he's high risk and he's highly likely to reoffend sexually and he needs commitment to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And that's what Dr. Doherty said, and that's what Dr. Keller said. And the court did specifically say he can't be in the community. That's not sufficient. And the court did make that finding based on the expert's testimony on those issues.
Counsel,
So
can you clarify? So, when we look at whether someone is a sexual psychopathic personality, we look at whether they're dangerous to other people. When we look at under subdivision 16, whether they're a sexually dangerous person, we look at whether they're likely to engage in acts of harmful sexual conduct. And it seems to me that violence or violent acts in terms of how the acts are perpetrated is just one piece of that. I think that if I'm reading it correctly, and if I've read the case law correctly, the fact of whether the court has found that it's harmful, the district court found that it was harmful, or finds that he's dangerous, it doesn't have to only be demonstrated by violent acts, however that is defined, but rather whether the danger or the harmfulness is demonstrated in other ways as well. Is that correct?
correct. But yeah, so that's what I was trying to say before, as far as the Linehan factors go. That's one piece of so much information that this court had. And it's one factor that our Supreme Court has said, if this is present, take a look at it, as far as how it goes to its high likelihood. But what, there's so much more, like I said, with all the various tools, and you have to look at the person's whole history, and you have to look at the other things that make them high risk. And while he may not have been violent in the way that he's jumping on top of strangers attacking them, I mean, his offenses were violent. His last victim, testified that he forced her and coerced her. And he had other victims that reported coercion and force. So, yeah, he's not beating his victims. He doesn't have a long history of that. But certainly his conduct could be considered violent, even with respect to sex offender victims, as far as some of the force and coercion that he used. But yeah, that's one thing that the court looks at. And violence is not required for somebody to be highly likely to reoffend sexually. And violence is one of the things that's looked at for SPP commitment also. And the case law is kind of mixed on how significant violence is, even from an SPP standpoint. But in this case, I would say it's there and it's one of the factors. But it's certainly not. I mean, there are certainly many more things that make this guy high risk to reoffend sexually and dangerous than the violent history. So I see that my time is almost up. If anyone has other questions, I'm happy to address them. All
Thank
right,
you.
thank you for your time, and we would ask that you affirm the district court here.
All right, thank you.
Thank
And
you.
now we will turn back to counsel for appellant for the last word. There are 5 minutes on the clock, and Ms. Tone, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you. Just a few comments here with my rebuttal time. I want to follow up on Judge Justin's kind of point about risk a little bit and some of Mr. Bryant's history and the facts related to that in the community. So Dr. Keller, adamantly opined that Mr. Bryant exposed himself while in jail. She repeatedly cited that he re exposed himself to jail staff. And I've got that cited in the brief and the final argument that that is incorrect. So she's repeatedly making assertions based on an incorrect understanding of the facts in the record. And she's providing a diagnosis, which she later concedes on cross-examination that she really can't provide. She's engaging in speculation, saying, well, this other inmate made this allegation, which was never charged or formally investigated against Mr. Bryant, and saying, well, clearly Mr. Bryant has also engaged in this behavior in the community. And I think when you look at the evidence as a whole, you're going to see that Mr. Bryant spent, I believe it was almost 15 years of his life in prison. And there was not one single allegation that he was exposing himself or inappropriate during any of that time. And there's no
May
allegations. Yes.
I? I'm sorry to interrupt, Ms. Tan. I just wanted to ask you, can you explain what weight we should put on the difference between exposing Mr. Bryan exposing himself to jail staff versus other inmates? Isn't the issue more towards what the state has argued that he was on a hold for a civil commitment and engaged in the act of exposing himself? Isn't that more significant than who he actually exposed himself to?
Well, I think there's kind of two parts to that answer. One, I certainly think it's more brazen to expose to jail staff. I think certainly you're more likely to get caught, written up, and all of that information obviously would come to light when you're in the middle of a extremely important court proceeding as compared to another, inmate in the jail. And so given that that allegation is coming from an inmate, I think you also, as the finder of fact, have to question the credibility of that allegation. And I think, the other key issue is that when the examiner giving the opinion is not correctly understanding the facts as indicated in the record, that opinion is flawed and problematic, yet it's determined to be credible.
But Ms. Tan, don't we have to defer to the district court's credibility determinations? And the district court in making those determinations is also able to take conflicting testimony into account, because certainly there are many instances probably where somebody makes a mistake or says something that's in conflict. And I think we're bound to defer to that.
I agree. And I guess that was, I think what I tried to point out in my original 15 minutes is that the finder of fact absolutely has that discretion, but it's not unfettered. It still has to be consistent with and supported by the record as a whole. And that's that Edwards case I referenced earlier.
And that brings me to another question. Let's assume that we, for some reason, agreed that there was no reason that the district court should have relied on the testimony by Dr. Keller, but you still have the testimony of Dr. Doherty, which was the examiner selected by respondent. And it seems to me that there's ample information and facts that were found based on Dr. Doherty's testimony. Do you take issue with his testimony as well?
Absolutely. And I think I have that detailed in my appellate brief and my final argument. I mean, I think he engaged in a lot of the similar issues that make his overall opinion flawed. You know, I tried to point those out both in cross-examination and then, you know, illustrating them in my arguments. You know, there were certain facts that he did not have correct. You know, one of the quotes that's just jumping out, I'd asked him about something in his report, and he's like, "Well, those aren't even my words." And I'm like, "But they're in your report. What do you mean they're not your words?" And I think he was trying to say that, you know, he took that from some other document or something. You know, but I think when you look at that opinion, and again, when challenged on what facts did you rely on, explain what this means and why you did things the way you did, he wasn't able to very clearly articulate and explain that. And the things that he pointed out and relied on are inconsistent with the record as a whole. And again, that's, you know, where I keep coming back to is that even though the district court, as the finder of fact, has the authority, it's not unfettered. It still has to be consistent with the record as a whole. And I don't think you get to that in this case when you look at all the evidence. You know, and the final point that I just want to make is that Mr. Bryan is on lifetime supervision. He does have that sex offender treatment program available in the community, and he spent 3.5 years in the community without committing a new sex offense. No arrest, no charge, no conviction. So I think there is ample evidence that he does not meet that criteria for commitment. And I'm up. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I just want to take a moment to thank counsel for both parties for the excellent briefing and for argument here today. The court will take the matter under advisement and an opinion will be issued within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.